Hello guys, welcome back to another Choc D podcast, more than your normal martial arts gym. Today we're going to be doing like more of a kind of Q&A session, because I put a couple of posts out the other day on Facebook and on Instagram, and we had loads of great feedback from quite a few people. So I want to answer some of the questions that people put out there. We're going to start off on the Instagram post. So there was a poster called Sierra Nighttide. She was saying that due to a major injury, she's not able to train anymore. She loves hearing why people train and how it calms the mind, as opposed to a lot looking at it as learning to fight. So why I enjoy competing, why I enjoy martial arts. Well, like I said on the first podcast, I came from a judo background. I've always been a bit of a kind of rough and tumble kid. So I liked the competition, and I liked the level of contact, and I liked learning how my body reacts and responds to different kind of impulses, different kind of challenges. That's what I enjoy about it, is the kind of physical challenge, because every single person that you come up against has a different conundrum, a different problem to work out, whether it's there. They've got fast reactions. They might box fast. They might be powerful punchers, powerful hitters, and it's whether you can have the mental clarity in order to work out what the answer to that problem is. As you kind of get up the rankings and stuff like that, and you start coming up against smarter and smarter fighters. In the first couple of rounds, they might have one strategy, and then they might move to like a plan B or a plan C in the later rounds. And this is why the kind of ongoing conundrum of kind of fight IQ starts kind of kicking in. And that's what I enjoy about it, is this not necessarily verbal communication. It's the skill in being able to spot patterns. It's the skill in being able to recognize when points have been scored or you've been lulled into a trap in order for them to land a secondary attack. This is great from a competition perspective, but also from a fitness perspective as well. It's like why people enjoy playing chess. It's the strategy, and then using your body in a physical manner, playing this more kind of strategy based game. Because yeah, all right, okay, fighting can hurt, and sometimes there's a bit of pain involved, and pain can be a great motivator, but when you're kind of immediately experiencing it, it can distract you. It can distract you away from the game. So understanding how you react and respond to pain and negative influence. This is also, like I say, a life lesson as well as a sporting lesson as well. From a kid's perspective, the kids don't really need to be trained at that level of intensity. It brings a different mindset, a different attitude to it. There's still the strategy game to play, and there's the protection factor in the fact that they're not hitting to the head. There's certainly some sort of like a change to the game. it's probably not as intense, but the work rate is high, and it's all about, like, for the kids, it's all about fun. It's just making sure that they see it as a game. This is why they wear the shin guards and the body pads and stuff like that. Can they land a kick to the body pad, and make it as much as a game of landing a body kick as opposed to a fight? Like I say, a lot of adults come in and they want to learn to fight. A lot of kids come in and they want to learn how to protect themselves should a fight happen. But it's also great for confidence and having that kind of mind-body connection. So when a kid's kind of channeled in that kind of way, people have different learning styles. So sometimes kids might not be doing very well at school. They may enjoy doing PE. And so learning about different fighting styles and different footwork patterns and stuff like that, something where they have to learn whilst also being active, it's great for these kind of hyperactive kids that may not necessarily be that academic, that they might just enjoy the physicality of it. And different people work in different ways. So that's why from a personal perspective, from a coaching perspective, dealing with it, adults and kids in different ways, this is one of the things that I look for towards kind of motivation and how they like to react and respond given the challenges that come up in the sport. So yeah, thanks for that one, Sierra Nighttide. I'll be tagging you into the Instagram post and the Facebook post and stuff like that. So keep an eye out for this answer. Next up, we had a guy on Instagram, Builder Dominic. I think he's doing our Ultra White Collar Boxing, and his question was how to prepare for the shock of stepping into the ring in front of a crowd, and how do you kind of channel that energy? Well, the thing is that because it's a combat arena, and there's a certain vulnerability that you put yourself in that kind of a situation. It comes down to whether you can walk the walk when you've talked the talk. And this again falls back to the mental side of things of building your confidence and having a good training structure in place. Have you kind of talked your way around saying, yeah, I've been training, when in actual fact you've maybe done 10 minutes, like a little 10-minute workout just to kind of pacify your guilt for that day? Or have you been getting up on the morning? Have you been doing like extra runs? Have you been doing extra training? And this is when you kind of put under that spotlight of being under the lights in front of a crowd, and you're aiming to perform. It can be quite imposing, because then it's like, shit, am I going to get found out here? Am I going to be able to step my performance up correctly? As I've been taught, have I been paying lip service to the training and just kind of thinking that I know how to fight anyway? They're thinking that I know how to box and this kind of thing. Or have you been listening intently in class, maybe even taking notes and that kind of thing, when you go on from training? And it's living the kind of fighter lifestyle. So this is what we've put people through for the Ultra White Collar Boxing. For those of you that don't know, it's an 8-week training course, two sessions a week, and we take people from pure novice to competition level in 8 weeks of training. And after that 8 weeks, they compete at the Barbican Centre against one of the guys that they've been training with for the previous 8 weeks, and all the coaching staff at Choc D do the matching and kind of try and pair those pair the fights together as closely as possible. So yeah, sometimes it can be a bit of a shock because it's like the pressure of, am I going to get found out? Is it, am I going to be confident enough when I get in there to do what I'm supposed to do, or am I going to drop into this like fight or flight psychology, and basically forget the stuff that I've done in the previous 8 weeks and just go back to windmilling? It's how well you can then replicate that training. When it comes to kind of channeling energy, the ultra-white collar boxing is fairly different to a normal competitive combat sport fight, because there's a certain kind of unknowingness about it. In a normal fight, you're against someone that you've maybe seen them on YouTube or something, but you haven't been party to how they spar or how they move or how hard they hit and that kind of thing. So you don't get that benefit in a normal competitive fight. And then also in a competitive fight against another gym, there's certain like that almost like gang mentality, that clan mentality where all your mates are cheering for you, all their mates are cheering for them. And I mean, a lot of our guys, we go into other people's backyards, onto their hometown shows, and put on a good fight. I think we're currently running around a sort of 85, 90% win ratio for Choc D. So we're certainly doing something right. And that's one of the things that I like, is to kind of go into a fight and basically rip up a script. If you're walking out and you're walking out to a crowd of boos and hisses and almost like a pantomime bad guy. I never used to take that on as emotion. I never used to take it on as negative energy. It was purely energy. So the more noise there was, the more energy there was, basically kind of charged me up. So the more that people booed, the more energy they gave me, so it made me perform better. You just have to be able to remove the kind of negative intent from it, I suppose. I mean, this is a great question because I've never really analysed it to this level of detail before. Certainly, if you're going into a fight with the kind of smallest insecurity, then that could be exploited by the crowd booing you when you went out. You could get drawn into that degree of like negativity and challenging your performance that way. But I mean, I always worked ridiculously hard, and I was always up at sort of 6, 7 o'clock in the morning. I'd be running for probably half an hour, 45 minutes before going to work. And then I'd be in the gym every night for 3, 4 hours, kind of doing my sparring, sport-specific training, bag work, extra strength conditioning work, and that kind of thing. So my confidence was seated in my work ethic. And that's why I was always kind of comfortable to step into an arena, be booed, and stuff like that. And it's yeah, for me, it was just kind of channeling energy and channeling that energy into a positive performance. And I'd be smiling and soaking it up. And the more they booed, the more I'd smile because I'd accept it as energy. But then they'd get more pissed off because I was smiling and laughing. So I don't think they realised that they were actually fueling me with their negative intent, because I was confident in my performance and my work rate. I knew that I'd never left any stone unturned, so I was happy to absorb that energy, and it basically G'd me up to fight. So yeah, all those the Buddhas when I was going into someone else's backyard. Thank you very much. It was great for my performance. So yeah, that was one of the things that we had on the Instagram post. On the Facebook post, there was a guy called let's have a look, Raymond Oldman. How to fit training in around work. Now, obviously, not everyone works a kind of 9 to 5, and some people work in the kind of service industry. So, when you're in the service industry, you're working when everyone else is off. So, like evenings and weekends are when people tend to be free and away from the 9 to 5. That's when the service industry is working. So, I suppose you have to kind of work out and manage your time into when you're available to train, and even if it's just doing something, even if it's just kind of going out for a run, doing some weights or that kind of thing. I posted a photograph on my Instagram the other day. It was for the kids that I teach up at the local private school, saying that they can still carry on with their daily training. They can still carry on with their daily training through half term, and they don't necessarily need a partner to be holding pads or anything like that. There's loads of other things that you can be doing on a daily basis which can boost your performance, whether it's from an individual perspective, looking at your kind of nutrition, sleep patterns, doing some goal setting and loads of other stuff. There's if you want to check out that post on my Instagram, it's Chuck D Academy, all one word, and you can find it up on there. So yeah, if you have a look at that, there's loads of like solo drills that you can do for the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu guys, for the Thai boxing guys, certainly shadow boxing and movement and dancing is a great workout in itself. And yeah, that dancing subject always makes people laugh a little bit, because they think that it's a bit, I don't know, like a little bit embarrassing. People don't like dancing. But at the end of the day, that's dancing is an example of movement, and fighting is an example of movement. So if you can move well, this is why good dancers make good fighters. Good fighters make good dancers. If you can move well, and you've got good control of your body, whether it's in a striking martial art or a grappling martial art, being able to transfer your balance and your energy to move around a partner, it's all about movement. It's all about having the balance and core stability in order to do that. So there's if you want to speak to us at the gym, we can give you a few more like individual drills to work on that. So thanks for that, Raymond. The next one was from Joe Prakash Singh. He wanted us to talk about the mix between spirituality and martial arts. Now, that's a huge subject. So I'll probably save that one for its own individual its own individual podcast, because as soon as we start getting involved with the internals of how people deal with their own struggles and their own like mental problems, their own kind of confidence issues, their own baggage and stuff like that, being able to carry that through into a understanding a higher purpose and understanding a great goal. That crossover between having the ethics and life code of living a warrior lifestyle, alongside learning the specific skills of a martial art. This is where a lot of martial arts kind of go back to. When you look at the roots of martial arts, it goes back to kind of feudal times, hand-to-hand combat on battlefields and stuff like that. There was a lot more kind of values and beliefs and kind of life attitudes towards the coaching and towards the training. So spirituality and martial arts do go hand in hand, and it's something that I'll expand on at a later date. So thanks for that one, Joe Prakash Singh. Next one was Adam Watson. Adam was asking about nutrition and exercise for truck drivers. So yeah, that's always going to be a tough one, when you're sat on your butt all day, driving these big Arctic lorries up and down the motorways and dropping off. Spend one of the guys that I work on ACB and Bama and UFC with. There's a guy called Andy Haig. He does a lot of truck driving. So being able to manage the nutrition around that, he shared his thoughts on that one with us a couple of times. So yeah, I've got a bit of an inside line there. As far as that is concerned, when you're out on the road, it's all about preparation, because eating for convenience, well, to be fair, this goes for everybody. Without preparation, then you're destined to fail. So you need to prepare your nutrition, and you need to kind of regulate your eating times and stuff like that. Now, as you start on new eating plans and kind of intermittent fasting things and stuff like that, I personally started experimenting with intermittent fasting at the start of this year, and I found it worked fantastically for my lifestyle. But one of the things that I do notice is sometimes that there's some energy lulls, and some kind of flat times where like maybe I've eaten too late, so I don't sleep too well, and therefore I don't have. I can feel the lack of energy the next day. So yeah, under having kind of stricter eating times, and then not eating for convenience, eating for choice, eating for fuel, then you'll learn to manage and make the right choices at the right time. So yeah, staying away from those like sugary sweets and pasties and stuff like that, and convenience food. It's having better preparation. It comes back to the 6 P's. Poor planning precipitates piss poor performance. So yeah, if you don't plan, then you're destined to fail. So you've got to work out what your calorific targets are, be able to kind of backtrack that into your macros, and understand what proteins, carbs, fats that you need, vitamins and minerals, or you're having enough fruit and veg, enough fiber in your diet, are you drinking enough water? And then the thing that I've noticed with this is that long-term weight loss goals don't happen as quick as people want them to. Now, you can go on like serious calorie deficit diets and things like that, to lose. Well, Pete Kerr talks about it on his stand-up. He talks about it, 18 stone in a day, and he likes holding out his pants in front of him and stuff like that. It's funny, because the quicker you lose it, the quicker you put it back on. This is like the weight cutting thing with fighters. You're looking to create an advantage by dropping weight really quickly to meet a weight limit, to then bounce that weight back on again, and then you can be, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 pounds heavier come fight time, literally in 24 hours. So that's the issue the difference between weight loss and weight cutting. Weight loss is a slow strategic thing where, like this year, I've lost around 10 kilos from since the start of the year, through my intermittent fasting, through my stricter targeted calorie goals, and I've felt a hell of a lot better for it. Whereas with weight cutting, you can see fighters drop 10 kilos in a couple of days. So, and then they'll bounce that weight straight back on again. The idea is that with weight loss, it's a strategy, it's a new eating plan, it's a long-term goal. You're thinking about, like, what's my weight going to be like in 5 years' time, as opposed to, can I meet this specific weight in a month? Because if you do it in a month, then you're probably not, it's going to be too intense and too hard for you to kind of stay there and maintain that level of intensity. So yeah, I'd talk to us about, come speak to us at the gym. We can talk about diet plans and that kind of thing, and I can help you out with that one. So yeah, thanks for that one, Adam. Next up was Chris Eaglin. Chris Eaglin was wanted to talk about the ups and downs of training, hitting the wall and slow progression. Again, this is looking for that. We drop into that like instant generation. We drop into that wanting an instant answer. We're wanting to see a step improvement in performance. The thing is that about like long term goals and things like that. It takes a long time. You need to be patient. Don't be thinking about that. I want to hit this goal by this particular time. When it comes to gradings and things like that, if you put yourself under that much pressure, then it's probably not going to happen. I mean, we've had people coming to the gym saying that they wanted to be a blue belt in jiu-jitsu in 18 months. Well, it's certainly possible. We've had people that have done that, but they've shown a fantastic level of commitment, work ethic. They've followed the instruction. They've trained really hard, and they've hit their goals. We've had other people that have come in and they've talked about wanting to hit their blue belt in 18 months, maybe even 2 years, and they've kind of turned up to training, but then it's also almost been like kind of attendance money, like turning up to work but not actually working. They're turning up to training, but they're not grafting. They're not putting in the grind. They're not putting in the hard work. So yeah, I mean, there's going to be ups and downs. There's going to be plateaus of training. The thing is that I was watching a TED talk the other day, and they started talking about that 10,000 hours of practice, in order to achieve a world-class level of performance. Now, the language for this got twisted. That's where it originally started out. Was 10,000 hours of practice to get to a world-class level of performance. And then it came to 10,000 hours of practice to get good at learning a new skill. And then that got diluted again to 10,000 hours of practice to learn a skill. And then it was 10,000 hours of practice to learn something. Now, it doesn't take 10,000 hours of practice to learn something. On the TED talk, they talked about the rapid acceleration that you go through when you first start out, but then you hit these plateaus, and it's like an exponential curve. You get the rapid acceleration when you first start out, but then when you start hitting the like 70% mark, that curve drastically shallows out, and then over the same time period that you've gone from 0 to 70% of the same time period, you maybe improve 10% of that next same time period. So if you've done like a year of training and you get to 70% of your blue belt, it could be another year again before you get another 10% of training. So when you start putting these figures in place, you realize that there's like plateaus to go through. You realize that there's these stumbling blocks. And sometimes this frustration is merely a motivator. It brings a certain value to to your goal. And it normally like with the jiu-jitsu guys, it's kind of like you get to a certain point and you go, well, okay, I'm just gonna stop searching for the next grading and looking for validation at that point. And I'm just gonna enjoy grappling for the sake of grappling. I'm gonna enjoy jiu-jitsu for the sake of learning. Because I mean, I'm only a blue belt at jiu-jitsu as well, so I'm kind of going through the same sort of things. I know what it felt like to be a white belt and get my ass kicked every session and stuff like that. And it's hard. That's what makes you tough. Sometimes you're the nail, sometimes you're the hammer. And this is how you get forged. This is how you get managed. So, yeah, understanding these ups and downs in training and hitting the wall and the slow progression stuff is frustrating. That's granted. But it makes those goals all the much greater when you get the recognition of that next belt or the next stripe and stuff like that. You see how excited people get as soon as they get to as soon as they start getting a stripe on the belt. To everyone else that doesn't know jiu-jitsu, that doesn't know the hard graft that goes into getting a single stripe on your belt, that can be like a couple of years under our association, under our grading system with our coaches. That's not necessarily saying that our coaches are bad. It's saying that you want the recognition and you want to be deep seated into that learning and then being able to do that at a higher level of intensity. So then you really deserve the reward and it's a pat on the back. Well done. Let's move on. So yeah, this is what happens. With each martial art that I've done, whether it's judo, whether it's Thai boxing, whether it's with jiu-jitsu, sometimes there's like pockets. These pockets are like hierarchical goals. And for a long time, you can be in a certain pocket, be in a certain group. And you'll work your way up, and like you'll maybe get to be the alpha in a certain group, but it takes a long time for you to stay at that alpha stage before people recognize it, before the coach recognizing it, and then it comes down to your attitude within that. Do you keep on doing the same things, or do you look to expand your learning and this is what we're talking about with people playing their A game all the time. If you just play your A game all the time, then you'll just get really good at doing that one thing. There may be gaps in your technical spectrum where you need to improve. So, for instance, for the in the in the jiu-jitsu front, I know Chris. He's got a fantastic top game. He's got a really strong pressure game. He's technical, and he knows how to apply pressure when he's on top. So maybe the next thing is working on his guard game. I'm not sure. It's been a while since me and Chris had a role. So yeah, I hope that might give an answer. It might be totally wrong. Maybe speak to Josh about it, and then we'll see if we can find an answer for that one, if that's how you're particularly feeling. But I know that there's quite a few people within the group that kind of feel this same frustration. So having the confidence to even talk about it and pose that as a question is fantastic because everyone feels it. One of the big things for me was when Chris Hauter came over and he did the seminar at Flinkers over in Bradford, and then he came and did the seminar at our gym. But at both of those, he said that there was it's not about who's best, it's about who's left. So in order to kind of stay in that position and learn, just be the guy that's left. Just stay there. Just be stubborn. And this is one of my things from a coaching perspective is stubbornness is a great trait to have because it means that you don't give up. Okay, so just keep going and just keep grinding on. The next question was from Stu over, or funnily enough, over at Flinkazan. He was asking about the sports side of MMA and how it's impacted the traditions of traditional martial arts, and if the dilution of those values have had a negative impact. Now, on that side of things, yeah, I mean, it's now become a thing of sports entertainment as opposed to traditional martial arts. It's now there's big spectacles, like you get like 100,000 people turn up to the UFC weigh-ins and stuff like that. Massive crowds at the open workouts and that kind of thing, because it's entertainment at the end of the day. And yeah, sometimes the traditional side of things, where people are like uber respectful and quiet and that kind of thing, they do get watered down, because at the end of the day, it's sports entertainment. People want to see passion. They want to be a pantomime good guy, a pantomime bad guy. They wants to be a backstory and stuff like that. And sometimes it does start getting like WWE, the professional wrestling and stuff like that. Those guys are still putting their bodies on the line and still throwing themselves around and jumping off the top rope and all this business. But they have a script to play to. It's just how they go about doing that. And it's great for the sport of MMA and bringing more and more people into the sport and interested in the sport. But from the benefit position that I get to see, like backstage when I'm doing the commissioning work, all these guys that are actually doing it, the people that are truly involved, the participants, they're still the consummate professionals coming back to strict martial arts. You start seeing a lot more people that kind of break down their martial arts into individual sports. So they'll do the Thai boxing, they'll do the jiu-jitsu, they'll do the wrestling, and then they'll have a couple of sessions where they start pulling it together in MMA sessions, and that's how you see a lot of the guys training and warming up, simulating strikes within their jiu-jitsu, simulating takedowns in their striking and when they're doing the pad work and stuff like that. It's like extra individual body moves to like open a window or offer an opportunity. So for instance, if they're boxing on the pads, sometimes they might do a jab cross left hook into a low kick, but then drop, change levels as if they were gonna wrestle in and shoot, or they might box, level change, step in and shoot underneath the defense that comes up. It's seeing this blend of ultimately mixed martial arts and taking it to that level, to that intensity. So yeah, some of the I particularly like each of the individual martial arts themselves, but I can see how for the purist in each of the martial arts, how MMA can be a bit kind of hybrid, and then it may lose the respect and it may lose the values, and it can have a negative impact towards the kind of viewing public. But the people that are actually doing the sport, are the ones that are still doing the traditional martial arts with the values, with the respect, with the good attitudes towards training, and they'll keep the respect there. And because at the end of the day, you still need to have those values in place. Yes, people are related when they win, but having honorability and respect when you lose is part of being human, part of being a man, part of being a woman. It is what it is. If you throw your teddy out the pram when you lose, then you look like a little kid. If you can be, you need to maintain those life skills alongside it. So yeah, that's my thoughts on that subject. Again, I'm going to be looking around and seeing if someone else will start podcasting with me, so we can have a chat about some of these things. So it's not just a monologue. So yeah, I hope that this has answered some of your questions. If there's some more that you're interested in, please hit me up, send me a message, and I'll try and answer it the best that I can. Hope you enjoyed it, and I'll speak to you soon, guys. Thank you very much. Peace out.